Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael, and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today we have one guest. Our guest is Dotun. Dotun is an infrastructure finance specialist or project finance specialist. Now we'll be discussing three topics. First of all, we'll discuss the controversy surrounding the Lagos-Calabar Coastal Road project. Secondly, we'll discuss the arrest and conviction of the Nigerian celebrity popularly known as Bob Risky. And thirdly, we'll discuss the impeachment of the Edo State Deputy Governor, Philip Shuaibu by the Edo State National Assembly. So to our first topic, Phoenix, the coastal road between Lagos and Calabar, isn't that supposed to be an exciting and laudable project? How on earth has this project ended in controversy, or how has it found itself in the midst of controversy, Phoenix? Can you talk us through the issues?
Hi, Michael, and thanks, Dotun, for joining us this week. Hello, listeners. The controversy ha has come about due to a number of different things that people have picked up on with the project. I mean, it's no surprise. Anything that we see in Nigerian public circles, there's always something dodgy about it that, very quickly comes to the fore, and this is no surprise. This is definitely along those lines. I mean, a number of things that people have raised. Firstly, I mean, there was the conversation around, first of all, I mean, there was this conversation around the landmark tourist place in Lagos that all of a sudden received a notice that they were supposed to evacuate within 7 days. Because this coastal highway was supposed to pass through that property. And of course that came to the notice of everyone, and that became the discussion that, I mean, in these times when the economy is struggling, we're looking for as much investment as we can. I mean, jobs will be lost. This is not the time that we should be wiping out businesses, because we want to build a highway, as laudable as it is, I mean, to the point that you are making. So that stirred up enough discussion. And of course, people started looking into the details of this highway. And that's when, other things started surfacing that became even more controversial. It turns out that this highway, we were originally told back in 2023 that this was going to be a PPP project. Now, for those who may not know, a PPP project is a public-private partnership. Typically, what happens is the government concessions a piece of infrastructure development to a private entity. They build using their own funds entirely. Government doesn't put up any money beyond just to provide the approvals, the right of way, all of the things that only government can do. But this private company is supposed to bring all the financing, make sure they do all the design, the build. And then what happens is that they're allowed to recoup their investment by, if it's a road, you're allowed to toll the road for, I don't know, maybe 20 years or 25 years or whatever it might be. So that was the initial thing we were told, which made sense given the paucity of funds right now and the fact that the federal government is actually not swimming in money. Then we find out that no, actually, it's not a PPP project. There's some government money that is going to go into it, and then we find out that it's been awarded to, which was the cherry on top, High Tech Construction, which is owned by Gilbert Shaguri, who, I mean, those well, who any political watcher would know is a very close associate of President Bola Tinubu. In fact, I think he was on Tinubu's entourage to what was the recent trip that he went on? Was it the one to Qatar? I can't remember.
Yes, it was
So,
Qatar.
exactly. So, I mean, without any competitive bidding, with nothing done, you just hand over a project of this magnitude to a company that is very close to the president, and then you start, and then you have Umahi, who is now trying to defend by saying, "Oh, it's not was not a PPP; it's meant to be an EPC and F." Now, again, that's supposed to be engineering, procurement, construction, and financing. So it's all become very muddled. It's all become controversial. What should be a great infrastructure project, where we're now looking at across a number of areas, and we're seeing people ask questions. Atiku Abubakar asked a number of very salient questions, and they're struggling as usual to answer, because it's all part of their murky, politics come rent seeking that we've come to expect, that has really come to the fore. So, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, but the real question is, what is the value that is being gotten by the Nigerian people? Where is due process and proper corporate governance in ensuring that, when you do things like this and you're going to spend significant amount of money, we're being told that the project is going to cost about 15 trillion naira over 8 years. That's significant. And to expect that this has not been done properly is just strange. So that's really what's, driving all the controversy and the outrage.
Thank you very much, Phoenix. Now, Dotun, I have a series of questions for you, but I think I'll start with this one. So, because your specialism is project finance, and as Phoenix said, the Minister for Works, Governor David Umahi, was on TV arguing that there was no need for a competitive bidding process because high tech has a unique set of skills that meant that basically they're the only ones who could deliver this project. Were you persuaded by David Umahi that there was no need for competitive bidding, Dotun? In your view, is this in accordance with best practices?
Hardly. There's so much to unpick here, as Phoenix said. I think Umahi was basically in the position of defending the indefensible. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that he didn't really know much about how this was awarded to high tech, but he's got to roll with it. I've never heard of any project, any infrastructure project of this size and dimension, whether it's a PPP project or whether it's purely funded by government, where there hasn't been a competitive bid. That's one thing. That's unique. I've never worked on any project like that, and I've worked on quite a few, both in Europe, and I've been involved with projects in Nigeria. So that's the first thing. Secondly, the idea that high tech is uniquely placed to deliver this project, I also find quite hair-raising. I mean, this is a company which, if I recall correctly, was awarded the Lagos-Ibadan Expressway contract and simply failed to deliver. Now, infrastructure projects of any kind, let alone those where there is a public-private partnership, take a long time to structure. It can take up to 3 years to get the structure right before you get to financial close and before you get anywhere near actually moving to construction. So, no, I'm not convinced. This project has been in the works for years. This has been talked about for years. And there is a link here with the also recently mentioned Coastal Railway project. Because if you recall, when this announcement was made, there was talk of five lanes either side with the railway running down the middle. Now, I won't even go there, but I think there is a distinct link between the announcement of this project and also talk about the coastal railway from Lagos to Calabar, also recently being awarded to to another company. But I'll stop there because you've got other questions.
Thank you, Dotun. So that's the first question. Then the second relates to the plans, because the company Landmark that owns a beach along the route was initially told that their land was going to be confiscated by the federal government because the road runs through that route. But then some people have alleged, and I think accurately, that this was not the original route of the road. And David Omahi was asked this question during a TV interview, and he seemed to imply that it was that having a beach, because the point a number of people made was that, look, there's no point having a coastline if people cannot take advantage of the coastline to enjoy beach-related activities, because that in itself brings in tourism. And Omahi seems to dismiss that and say, look, the focus should be on the economic benefit of having the road, and having a beach was neither here nor there. So I just want to get your views on that. First of all, do you know why they changed the route? And secondly, this idea that having a beach or tourism arising from that is something that is not that important. Is that your view, Dotun?
No, it's not. There's no obvious reason why they've changed the route. Now, let's go back a few years here. Firstly, the Lekki was originally the expressway that runs through Lekki was something that was conceived by Governor Jokande back in the early 80s. And without him, nothing along that peninsula would exist. Now, the plans for Lekki actually should have the original plan was that there would be three roads passing through Lekki. And as you know, to date, there is only one. So there would be another road that would pass along the Atlantic coast, and there would be another one that passed along the shoreline of the lagoon on the opposite side of the peninsula. Now, if you look at the coastal roads in other countries, whether Benin Republic, Togo, Ghana, the idea is that all these countries would have roads that linked each other, making it much easier to travel from one to the other. Nigeria is the exception. Number of reasons for that. We have a much larger coastline. There is going to be significant expense in building such a road because of the terrain. Interestingly, we're also the only one of those countries where it is very difficult to access a public beach. You can stroll to the beach in most of our neighboring West African countries without a problem, whereas most of our beach areas, you have to pay to access. Now, it is certainly the case that this road did not originally, as conceived, run through the property that Landmark now operates from. The route has been changed and it goes slap bang through Landmark. And I mean, it is bizarre that you would then give the guy, the owners, 7 days to move out. We're talking about an area where there has been serious multiples of dollar investment. I think the gentleman that runs Landmark said that he's invested about $150, $150 million, sorry. Now, leaving that to one side, in any case, you wouldn't build that road right along the beach side. You wouldn't build it immediately adjacent to the coastline anyway. There are environmental reasons, not least, coastal erosion. I mean, look at where Eco Atlantic is now. Once upon a time, Bar Beach was there. And before Eco Atlantic was built, Bar Beach had pretty much eroded almost completely to the point where all the properties along Abandu Belo Way would flood constantly before flood defenses were put in place, which is now known as the Great Wall of Lagos. So even if you were building that road, you wouldn't build it right along the beach, right next to the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, it's just, you know, from an engineering and environmental perspective, it does not make sense. Why they have changed that route so that it does pass through Landmark's property right on the beach, your guess is as good as mine. The fact that they issued a notice to Landmark actually has done us all a bit of a favor because it immediately exposed that there are bigger issues here. Had they simply said, we've awarded a contract to High Tech, then this might have passed under the radar. But that notice to Landmark made a lot of us sit up and look much faster. And the one thing I'll add before your next question is another mystery. As I said, nobody seems to know why they've changed the route. If you're building a coastal road, which ostensibly is supposed to link Nigeria with our neighbors and go all the way to Calabar, why on earth would you start slap bang in the middle of Lekki with a 47-kilometer stretch of road that really simply runs between Eko Atlantic and Ibeju-Lekki?
Thank you, Dutton. I need to bring in Phoenix at this point. Phoenix, you've heard the last question Dutton posed, which was actually something I was going to ask you, because a number of commentators have made this point as well, Phoenix, that look, this road basically seems to benefit Eko Atlantic. And Eko Atlantic happens to be owned by Gilbert Shagori. Gilbert Shagori is also apparently the owner of High Tech. But when this question was put to David Umahi, David Umahi said he's not aware of any relationship between Shagori and High Tech, and he's also not aware of any relationship between Bola Tinubu and Shagori. So my first question to you, Phoenix, is that a plausible explanation that Umahi did not or does not know that Bola Tinubu and Shagori have a relationship, Phoenix?
Well, that one is strange to me because I mean, I just mentioned now that Shaguri was on Tinubu's entourage as recently as a few weeks or months ago. So, if he doesn't know, then he must be the most unaware member of that FEC. But then again, knowing Umahi's antecedents. As I believe he's an engineer, and he was actually lauded for all of the construction work that he did in Ebonyi. So he knows the construction space very well. There's no way that he doesn't know High Tech, because he was actually telling us that High Tech is the one that has thank you, Dotun. Dotun is actually also confirming that Shaguri was on the COP delegation. So I mean, for somebody who has done such work in the construction space, he obviously knows High Tech very well because he was telling us that High Tech is the he was invited because of their competence and capability in this space, especially with work that they had done with Eko Atlantic and the surge control with the beach. Now, it's impossible that you know the company that well and their capability and don't know who's behind the company, and don't then know that there's a connection with Eko Atlantic. So, again, this is all, it just makes him look ridiculous. I mean, all these denials and things that they're doing is ridiculous. But what is more important for us as Nigerians is the idea that public funds are being used to benefit private investments. That is the question that Nigerians have to be asking. Because Dotun is spot on. The way if you listen to Umahi and what he was saying about this whole coastal highway of 700 kilometers, they're doing it. They've called out section 1, 2, and 3 as the immediate parts to start. Section 1 and 2 Section one starts from Ahmadu Bello way and goes all the way through to Lekki. That's the one that people are saying that, look, this is clearly, creating a road to benefit this Eco Atlantic and to benefit Shaguri. But it goes beyond that. You then look at what Section two is supposed to do, I think, all the through Oguntu, Ondo. Then all of a sudden, they jump to the other end in Calabar to come into Akwa Ibom for Section three. Tell anybody who at least puts their thinking cap on can see already that that is probably to benefit Akpabio. So you see how all of this thing is just coming together to leverage public funds to either create political favors or even more dastardly to do this to create benefit for private individuals, and the president himself is entangled in it. It's always been a case that his hands, his fingerprints are all over Eco Atlantic, and that he's a beneficiary or that he's in bed with the Shaguris. At some point, people were even saying that high tech belongs to him.
That's the follow-up question I was going to raise, because truth be told, Phoenix, from my own understanding of high tech, I'd always been led to believe that the company was owned by Bola Tinubu. And if you go online and look at some reputable Nigerian newspapers, even the Premium Times and The Guardian, in the past, as far back as 2012, they'd all referred to high tech as Bola Tinubu's company. So it's only been a recent development that it's now being called Shaguri's company. The suggestion by Nigerian newspapers had always been that Bola Tinubu was a had a key stake in the company. So the question is it appropriate for the government to award a contract to basically for the president to award a contract to himself? Does this pass the what they'll call the smell test, Phoenix?
You can never pass the smell test, never. But this is Nigeria. The question, you're basically looking at state capture, and it's one instance after the other that we keep seeing. You're basically looking at state capture because you have a National Assembly that is not going to do anything about it. Instead, like I said, they would also be taken care of. As I alluded to, potentially the fact that Section 3 all of a sudden jumps to Calabar to Akwa Ibom is tells us that Akwa Ibom will get his own share as well. So they just this was the concern with this band of politicians coming to power. It was the fact that they would come in, not focus on how do we get things right and turn around the fortunes of 200 plus million people to make this country productive, but rather how do we carve up whatever is left and make sure that we take care of ourselves?
Thank you, Phoenix. And my final question on this topic will go to Dotun. Dotun, the man, Gilbert Shaguri, seems to have a very colorful past. At many times he was involved. I think he even refunded $300 million to the Nigerian government that he apparently laundered on behalf of General Sani Abacha, who was supposedly a sworn enemy of Bola Tinubu. So, how do you think, or do you know, Dotun, how he's been able to maneuver himself into the upper echelons of the Nigerian power structure?
It's a good question, and what I'll say is this: it isn't obvious. I mean, he was indicted for money laundering in Switzerland. There are various other legal trails around his business dealings. Elsewhere outside this country. He seems to have, Gilbert Shaguri seems to, and his family seem to have relationships with the Tinubus going quite a way back. If you think about it, though, it's not unusual. There are sort of businessmen and political players in Nigeria who have managed to change allegiances, and almost whoever's in power, they've been able to make themselves useful one way or another. This guy seems to be particularly adept at staying on the right side of the right people. I mean, years ago, when I was actually working in Nigeria and Eco Atlantic was first conceived, it wasn't on my work agenda, but I did go and visit. I had a look around. I saw all their plans and I asked a lot of questions. I didn't get any answers to them because I wanted to know what was in it for Lagos State, where they had basically sort of laid out the welcome mat and given the sugaries everything they needed to make this project work. And I just could not see where the benefit was coming from for the people of Lagos State, taxpayers, and so on. So he has been very adept at switching his allegiances and using, no doubt, his significant financial clout to ingratiate himself with whoever happens to be in power. Compared to others, they try to keep a bit of a lower profile. So the exposure here is probably unwelcome. But as I said, there are so many loose ends here. That 47 kilometer section is very much going to benefit Shaguri's business interests in improving access to Eco Atlantic. He's not the only one. There are other people with businesses along that corridor who are also going to benefit. I'll mention quickly, as I said, there is a separate project to build a coastal railway, which has also been a mythical beast, which has been talked about for decades, but has never really happened. That project was awarded to another company, which was incorporated in the UK. I think it's called MFH, very, very recently, with a share capital of a mere £100. There are a number of directors listed. One of the directors of that project is a former deputy speaker of the Lagos State House of Assembly. This coastal road project mentions building a railway down the middle or with five lanes of road either side, all the way to Calabar, which is ridiculous from an engineering and construction point of view, which I won't even bother going into. And again, I just have to return to this laughable idea that you do not need to tender. That is just ridiculous. We haven't heard the last of this. I actually personally don't think a single brick would be laid for this road, because even if it's not a public-private partnership, if it was a PPP, the Shaguri's, Hi-Tech would have to pull together a special purpose vehicle, a consortium to raise the money. And clearly, with the change, now they're talking about government money going into it. They're not going to bother doing that. I'm highly skeptical that anybody would invest anyway without much more detailed work being done. And there are so many factors. And in any case, I actually do not believe that the government has the money if they're going to pay for this out of their own pocket. So I think this will rumble on and on. And my guess is that we'll still be talking about it. Let's just say in a year's time, let's see where we get to. But oh,
Thank
sorry,
you.
there was one other thing I wanted to point out. You guys will know, and others listening to the pod may be aware, that there is a family of Indian origin billionaires called the Guptas who got into a lot of trouble in South Africa, and there was a lot of talk of state capture because they were so close to the then president, President Zuma. Some of those guys are now on the run. As we know, Zuma's out of office. There are still lots of court cases swirling around. And all this stuff around the Shaguris and their grip on things and their closeness to the current president, Tinubu, immediately puts me in mind of the Guptas. So that was just something I wanted to add.
Thank you, Dr. I think the final comment, I've done some research on the Shaguri, and there's something interesting. Perhaps it's just a coincidence, but sometime in 1993, as we know, Bola Tinubu had to forfeit $460,000 that were alleged to be the proceeds of drugs. But interestingly, in those same 90s, somewhere around that same date, the Shagoris were said to have contributed $460,000 to the Clinton presidential campaign. So I wonder what it is about that 460,000 figure, if there's any coincidence there, especially as it happened around the same time, or if there's more to it, or it just happens to be an unexplained coincidence. But anyway, to our next topic, which concerns Nigerian celebrity whose stage name is Bob Risky, but his actual name is Idris Okuneye. So, Phoenix, Bob Risky or Idris Okuneye, there's still speculation whether it's is he transgender or cross-dresser. But anyway, he's been sentenced for naira abuse for 6 months without the option of a fine. Now, Phoenix, is this has the naira so-called naira abuse, is this really an offense, and has it been is it enforced this strictly in Nigeria, Phoenix?
Well, I mean, the first question, yes, it is an offense, although
Sorry, I
it's.
think your volume is a bit low, Phoenix.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you better now.
Okay. So to your first question, yes, it is an offense, though loosely defined. I mean, in the sense that, what does it mean to mutilate the naira? Because it's a spectrum, right? I mean, it's stamping on the naira, tearing the naira, squeezing the naira. Is that the same as spraying the naira? So there's never been very clear definition to my mind. Now, we know that there was a time when there was some noise about, oh, these people that spray naira at social events, we're going to clamp down on them. We never saw it happen. Why? Because it's the, I mean, the people who spray money at the, I mean, everybody practically does it. And so you'll be going after the same politicians who are in power. So it's never been enforced, at least not to my memory, have I seen a case of this type. And maybe I just missed it, or maybe I don't recall it at this point in time. So it made it interesting that this chap, they went after this chap for this. Now, what we know is there were actually six counts that were put forward against him by the EFCC, four counts of naira mutilation, two counts of money laundering. The judge struck out the money laundering cases or counts, but upheld the four counts. And those four counts were basically, videos of him having been spraying, a musician or spraying at a social event. So of course, people have therefore been putting out videos showing loads of other people who have been captured doing the same. This is a widespread phenomenon in Nigeria. At every party you go to, people are competing against themselves how much they can spray or what kind of style they spray money. And even top politicians have been seen to do the same. Even, I mean, at the highest of levels in Nigeria today, I'm sure if we go and look for videos, you will find videos of such people who have done this. So it begs the question, was this really why they went after this chap, or was it a camouflage for something else? And of course, he ended up being convicted, and now he's been jailed for 6 months, and we see what comes of it. And the question now is, should we expect the FCC to bring more of such cases? That remains to be seen.
Thank you, Phoenix. Dotun, I want to ask a question which builds on what Phoenix said. So he said a number of commentators have produced videos of other famous people spraying money, as they say in Nigeria. In fact, there's videos of Bola Tinubu's daughter, who was engaged in the same spraying of the naira at a party, and none of those prominent people have ever been arrested. So the question is, in your view, why have they decided to pick on Mr. Bob Risky? Do you think it's really about spraying of the money, or do you think there's more to it than that?
There's definitely more to it. I mean, crikey! As far as I know, spraying has been going on since the 70s. I don't know how long it's actually been in legislation that it qualifies as defacing the naira. I mean, Bob Risky's been kind of poking the establishment for a while in terms of things that he said and things that he's done, and it doesn't surprise me that sooner or later, they were going to go after him. Why they've chosen now on this particular incident, I don't know. I mean, there was a time he had a birthday party and the police raided it. I think he was fortunate enough to have left by the time they got there. The authorities are clearly trying to send a message. It's interesting that it's the EFCC that went after him. I mean, crikey. Given the levels of corruption in the country, chasing after some poor guy who for spraying money at a party is ridiculously excessive. The penalty, really, for what under the charge that he was convicted of, the penalty is 6 months in jail, a fine, or both. There is, and I've consulted trial lawyer friends about this and just said objectively, what do you think? And you will note that he pleaded guilty. I think he must have been advised that he would be banged to rights because he did actually spray the money. But however, the expectation was that this was a low-level offense, and I'm sure his lawyers were expecting that he might receive a fine, which is 50,000 naira. And there was some discussion amongst, trial lawyer classmate friends of mine as to what would happen next. And there wasn't an absolute consensus other than that the sentence was ridiculously harsh. He could easily have been given a fine. They all said, well, he can appeal. However, the problem is that it's likely that the judge had some discretion as to the punishment. His appeal would most likely say, well, this was perverse to impose the maximum penalty in such a case. But it depends on whether whoever hears the appeal is could easily lean on the fact that the judge had some discretion and they wouldn't tamper with that. It's interesting, though, that, on a WhatsApp forum that I belong to, where LGBT issues across the whole of Nigeria are quite sensitive and people have quite entrenched views. But it was obvious that in this conversation amongst lawyers, and I'm talking about people with 35 years post-call experience, they all said that leaving aside what this guy's lifestyle is, in a supposed crime where he had not actually, there was no victim, nobody was hurt or anything, that it was ridiculously harsh to impose a penalty. And as Phoenix said, where there are so many examples, videos online, I mean, crikey, there was, there are videos of people spraying at the immediate past vice president's son's wedding, I believe. There are just so many examples. You've mentioned the daughter of the current president. Too many examples to mention. Now, they've gone after him for a reason. He has previously alluded to having relationships with people who are wealthy and powerful. So whether somebody's reached out and kind of wants to tweak his ears and teach him a lesson, whether it is just being heavy-handed in trying to say to others that, who live alternative lifestyles, that perhaps if you stick your head above the parapet, beware of what's happened to Bob Risky, because this could easily be you. But it's a bit like there is a parallel with the topic that we've just discussed, the Coastal Road, because with social media, in the same way that that notice that was issued to the owners of Landmark, which immediately stirred things up and got people talking, this has done the same thing. You know, it's gone viral. And as I said earlier, even people who do not necessarily agree or support Idris or Kuneye's lifestyle, there is an ounce of humanity where they are thinking, well, you know, this is wrong. You know, it's a sledgehammer, using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. And as always in these cases, you have to put yourself in the position to say, well, crikey, would I want the EFCC coming after me? So it's got people talking. Now, this is Nigeria. So, you know, A, there's another issue coming along in 5 minutes. How long people will keep talking about it, whether it will just die down and people will forget about it. But I'm kind of hoping that it will build and people will keep talking about it and will say to the government that, you know, is it right? Is this the sort of thing that the EFCC was set up to prosecute? You know, is there value in this? You know, and are you really saying it's equitable to chase after one poor social media influencer when the rich and the powerful have been doing this in open sight for decades and have never been prosecuted?
Thank you, Dotun. Phoenix, the other question is, as I think Dotun has touched on, but I want you to expand further, is on the issue of the rights of homosexuals, lesbians, and the transgender and cross-dressing community in Nigeria. Should they be worried? And do you think this might lead to a sustained crackdown on people who lead alternative lifestyles in Nigeria?
I mean, I would not be surprised. I mean, we know that, I mean, this is Nigeria where a law was passed criminalizing that, right? So it's just a function of whether a particular administration chooses to go hard prosecuting it. So I think people have I think it's fair for them to be worried and concerned that there might be a crackdown. You know, that's where we are. It's part of the Nigerian, you know, construct that this is frowned upon, and then we saw it actually codified into law. So I would not be surprised if there was a crackdown, and you know, maybe this has those undertones as well.
Cool. Thank you. And then to Dotun, the final question on this topic is with regards to the speed. A number of commentators said, look, usually court cases in Nigeria, even criminal prosecutions, last years. How come this was done to within in less than 3 months from his arrest to his conviction and sentencing? What do you think was behind the speed? Do you think there's somebody in government who is pursuing a vendetta against Bob Risky?
Well, quite right to mention the speed with which the prosecutorial authorities have moved. They never usually move that quickly in any case. And yes, you know, at the risk of coming across like a conspiracy theorist, which is a national sport in Nigeria, let's be frank, there is clearly somebody who was determined to make this happen and make it happen quickly. I mean, one of the lawyers I spoke to said, well, in normal circumstances, he would apply for bail, and this being a non-violent crime, et cetera, would be given bail pending an appeal being filed, and the appeal would have a reasonable chance of expectation of the penalty being reduced to the fine. However, there are other issues tied up in that as to, you know, whether an appeal court could challenge the discretion of the judge in choosing a prison sentence rather than the fine. But let's leave that to one side. But that's what should happen. You know, he'd be able to apply. He'd have bail, probably with some restrictions, and he'd wait for his appeal. One cynical colleague said, "Well, the chances are that they won't give him bail, and he'll be stuck in jail, and he'll do the 6 months, and he'll still be waiting for the appeal by the time he served his sentence." The speed with which they've moved, clearly somebody was either trying to send a message or trying to wrap Bob Risky over the knuckles, or possibly both. There's no other reason that explains that this was brought so quickly. I mean, the EFCC is supposed to deal with high profile cases, and to my knowledge, since they've been set up, I can't think of a single instance where they have acted against anyone, and they're supposed to go after significant folks. They've prosecuted various professionals, ex-political post holders, but never have I known them to move with this much speed, considering the backlog of cases in the court. So, yes, I think I probably speak for many in saying, while I have no idea who that individual or who those people may be, there is clearly somebody determined to sort of enforce this and do it by getting the EFCC to move at the speed of light.
Thank you, Dotu. And just to conclude, I think a prominent human rights lawyer in Nigeria, Chidi Odinkalu, I think he's also a professor at Tufts University in Boston. I think he also pointed out that it's even debatable whether the prosecution of Bob Risky was within the EFCC's authority, that the ambit is supposed to be for economic and financial crimes, and it's not quite clear how spraying money falls within their remit. But anyway, on to our final topic, which is happening in Edo State, my home state. Some would describe it as the greatest state in Nigeria, and I would not disagree with them. But Phoenix, the deputy governor of Edo State, Philip Shuaibu, has been impeached. Can you tell us what is going on, Phoenix? Why is the greatest state of Nigeria in the middle of this political drama?
Michael, I thought you were going to take this one yourself since you're proclaiming it the greatest state in the history of Nigeria. But let me try and set the ball rolling. You'd have to have been living under a rock if you did not know that there have been issues between Governor Obaseki and Deputy Governor Shuaibu over the term of their. I think, well, since they came into the second term, basically. Of course, and that has been rumbling on. There have been talk about, this power tussle and things like that. And, Nigerian big men do not take kindly to people challenging their authority.
Oh,
Especially.
your volume seems to have gone low again, Phoenix.
Sorry, is it better now? Sorry, this
Oh,
headset is.
yes.
So Nigerian big men do not take kindly to their authority being challenged, and so it was inevitable that this would come to a head at some point. What has surprised me is that actually this took this long, and maybe, and I kept thinking about it, and I was like, maybe it was actually on purpose that this impeachment was delayed until now to ensure that it would kill the possibility of Shaibu being able to fulfill his ambition, because we all know that he expected to replace Obaseki, and obviously expected Obaseki's support. That's typically what happens. If you're the deputy governor, you're almost like the king in waiting. And basically, what you are expecting is that once you, especially if you are able to go for a second term together, that the second term is basically setting you up for your own run at the end of the 8 years. But obviously, by the time they started having issues, it was clear that that was not going to be on the cards. And we saw Obaseki, begin to show his support for Asue Ighodalo. which meant Shaibu had to take matters into his own hands if he was going to be able to fulfill his own ambition. We saw what happened with the PDP primaries, two different factions. One declared Ighodalo, another one declared Shaibu, and Shaibu starting trying to stake his claim. So it's made for an interesting political season. As we all know, the elections will be this year, but I mean, it also makes for a another constitutional challenge and issue for Nigeria, because it also brings to the fore the misuse of our instruments of governance, our political structure. When you have state assemblies, and we've seen this over time, you know, sit, you know, and find ways to impeach people, and you cannot point to exactly what is the offense that has been committed that has led to impeachment. You know, it's just become a political tool that people use, and that creates significant issues, right? So for me, that it but the bigger that's the bigger issue for me. But there's also a parallel issue that I keep looking at, and looking at the PDP and what it has become today. And I'm sure you may even have that on your list of questions. But it just continues to show the PDP as a departure from the party that it was and was meant to be when these kinds of things happen, you know. Not being able to put his house in order, not being able to make sure, you know, people have the right, that there are people that can make sure that the right things happen or the right conversations happen or grievances are resolved and things like that. And then they escalate into things like this that undermine the party and of course the states, the Edo states, you know, itself. Now, this, I mean, maybe it's good, because what it also does is it makes way for a change, right? So, I mean, if PDP has been in governance for 8 years, maybe it's time for other people to come there. So, we see what happens as a result. Very interesting in your states, Michael. You can't tell them to behave themselves.
Thank you, Fix. I'll relay the message. Now, to dot on the other aspect of this is the fact that Obaseki's lawyer, I mean, not Obaseki, Philip Shoaibu's lawyer, a senior advocate of Nigeria and a professor, Professor Awoyale, apologies if I've mispronounced his name, the professor said, look, the impeachment should not be, the proceedings should not be taking place because there is a court order from the Federal High Court restraining the House from conducting the proceedings. But the House still went ahead to do so anyway. And their argument was that the Constitution forecloses any interference in impeachment proceedings. Now, Dr. In your view, which argument seems more plausible? Do you think the House has the right to disregard a court order?
No, in no case legally are you able to ignore a court order. But you know, a couple of things. You know, as somebody famously said, this is not Nigeria. Anything where you see, you go take 'em like that. The truth of the matter is, there've been so many. Sorry, I do apologize. My got to find a way of turning this phone off. There have been so many instances, you know, in recent times where one arm of government has ignored a court order and simply gone ahead to do what they're going to do and dared the other party to do their worst. I think it's partly because there's so much what I call judicial shopping these days. You know, you want to get a court order, you decide whether you're going to go to the high court in your state, or sometimes you think, oh, the federal high court might be more likely to do what I'd like them to do. There's a lot of that going on. And in this case, I think the House having decided what it wanted to do, just thought, well, we'll do it. We dare him to go back to court or to find a way to enforce this order. And even if he gets some way down the road to being able to do that, it will frankly be too late. So I hate to say it, but we used to pride ourselves on the strength of our legal system and our judiciary generally. And there has been a degree of erosion in the trust in our judicial institutions. And that also goes for the legislature. In no way should they have disregarded a court order. It's blatant. It shows a complete disregard. And you might also say to the House, well, how would you feel if you passed legislation and everybody stuck two fingers up and said, well, we're not going to bother complying with that? Goes back to what you've both said. I mean, I spent a couple of years in your great state. I have a lot of friends there. I know that the politics can be quite sensitive. I understand that all of this stems from which senatorial district had the right to put forward successors, potential successors to Governor Obaseki, and the view that Shaibu was being a bit of a young upstart, not waiting his turn, demanding to be heard. And I think in Edo State particularly, you are not going to ride roughshod over the grandees, whichever party they're in. They've been around too long. They're too entrenched. They're too powerful. They simply weren't going to stand still for it. And Shaibu's reaped the whirlwind. I'm not entirely sure that I agree with the fact that, you know, with his supposed view that, well, you know, to borrow a phrase, it's my turn. I don't think it was. He clearly stirred up a hornet's nest by not going quietly. And the state establishment has basically closed ranks in the party and shut him out. It's not unique. We are seeing shades of a similar thing in River State. We are seeing it in Ondo State. I doubt there's a state of the Federation where something like this hasn't happened, you know, since the, crikey, what are we on? The Fourth Republic has been up and running. It'll be interesting to see what Shaibu does next, whether he sits and goes quietly or whether he goes back to court and tries to bring some sanction, get the court to apply some sanction to the State House and enforce the court order. I mean, even that's not unknown. We've had instances where people have been elected as governor or as legislature, and that election has been overturned in the courts. So this might not be the end of the matter. It probably isn't the end of the matter.
Thank you, Dotun. Phoenix, there's another interesting angle to this story because, funny enough, I was watching a video of the former governor of Edo State, Adams Oshiomole. Now, Adams Oshiomole was talking about the fact that he has no sympathy for Philip Shuaibu because this same Shuaibu conspired with Obaseki to deny, I think, about 9 or 10 legislators access to the House of Assembly. He and Obaseki apparently refused to swear them in, and therefore for a long time, APC, the opposition, had no representation in the House of Assembly. And Oshiomhole's view is, well, you supported illegality then, and now illegality has been used to impeach you. How do you respond to this, Phoenix?
Well, I mean, one can say Oshiomhole has a point. I mean, people always say that if you don't be a party to the right thing, you should not be surprised that it will be waiting around the corner for you. But I've never subscribed to that. I mean, at that time that it was illegal, people called it out that it was illegal, and the right thing should have been done. Now, it is illegal, or or and if an illegality is happening now, it should also be called out and things should be done. I think for me, again, the more I look at our democracy, I keep feeling, I can't help feeling that we as a people are not doing enough. And you know, and maybe this is the democracy we want, this is the democracy we deserve. Because you know, it's not going to just be a you're not just going to, what I'm beginning to realize is you're not just going to get good governance simply because you wish it. You're going to get good governance because you demand it, because you make sure that the structures do it for you. And it looks like, you know, we're willing to just go along with it. I mean, where is the, I mean, Edo State is known for very politically savvy people. Right, it's a fact. I mean, we see it whenever you know there are political discussions in Edo State. The people are very much into it. They, I mean, look at the look at Peter Obi's rise and the obedient movement. A lot of people trace it to Edo State. Even Obaseki at one point mentioned that there were obedience in his whether his household or in his government or you know, to have a small party be that dominant, you know, in Edo State spoke to the political awareness of the people in Edo State. So, I mean, if people in Edo State are not going to rise up and demand that the right thing be done, that these kinds of illegality not be allowed, I don't know, it's one or two things. It could be that maybe they've decided that Shuaibu is in the wrong and they're not interested in him, so they're not stepping up for him, or they're simply just not taking their political awareness to the degree of no, every single time the right thing should be done. Not picking and choosing, because when you pick and choose and create that inconsistency, what happens is that when you then need it to work for you, it will not work for you. So there needs to be that, you know, active participation and demand for good by the citizenry. You know, otherwise you get this scenario where, you know, state assemblies are just doing whatever they want because they don't fear the right of recall that can be wielded by the people. And then talk less of the ones that are in Abuja, where we think we have a democracy. You know, we have the structures, but we truly do not have a proper democracy that is functioning. And until we get that, we'll continue to have these kinds of you know, ridiculous scenarios.
And my follow-up, Phoenix, because one of the things Dotto also mentioned was that he did not think it was Shuaibu's turn to be governor. But I suppose the question is, when Obaseki was having serious problems or arguments with Oshiomhole, Shuaibu, you who used to be an Oshiomhole loyalist, switched sides and supported Obaseki, and it was rumored that the understanding was that after Obaseki completed his tenure, he would back Shuaibu. So, do you think there's been an unfairness here, Phoenix? Or do you think Dotu is right that it's Shuaibu should take a back seat and it's not his turn?
Well, I don't recall. I don't know the context in which Dotun was here, and I'll let him speak for himself. I suspect that what Dotun was speaking to was, you know, the rotation across the senatorial zones. Well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I don't know where Shuaibu come hails from, and whether, you know, because I keep hearing that whether it's the turn of is he Edo Central or something.
Yes, Edo Central, but Shuaibu is from Edo North.
Exactly. So I think maybe and Dalton, please chime in if I'm misrepresenting you. But I think the point I will make to what you say, Michael, is yes, we all know that without Shaibu's support, Obaseki's path was difficult. There's no doubt about that. You know that he brought support from Edo North, he added to the coalition to help, you know. And so if they had an agreement, you know, unless Obaseki will come out and tell us why he believes that Shoaibu will not make for a good governor, I mean, there should be honor, you know, and people should learn to respect their agreement. So I mean, I can understand if Shoaibu is aggrieved from that perspective, doesn't mean I think that he will make for a good governor. I mean, and considering the field that we have now, if I were to rank, he would not be in my top two, looking at the people who have shown interest. So, but if there was an agreement on the basis of you support me, you be my deputy, you'll be first in line, then there is it's reasonable to expect that Obaseki should explain why he's decided to go against that.
Well, thank you, Phoenix. I think Dotun, I think you wanted to respond.
Yes, I did. So, thanks, gentlemen. First thing I will say was I wasn't saying categorically that it's Shaibu's turn. The observation I was making, which you've just touched upon, is the issue of rotation between senatorial districts. And I think it is on record that Obaseki is alleged to have said to Shaibu, it can't be you because, you know, it's not the turn of your senatorial district. Now, touching on something else that Phoenix just said, we don't know what was agreed in smoke-filled rooms where these deals are done. And this goes on all the time, where one party will say, well, I was promised X and we shook hands on it and so on and so forth. I mean, it may well be, as Phoenix said, that says that Shaibu was told by Obaseki that in return for your support, because as you guys have noted, he did switch sides. His mentor, or ostensibly his initial mentor, was Oshiomole. He switched sides and supported Obaseki against Oshiomole, and perhaps there was a promise made that, you know, he would be allowed to run. We don't know. You know, you've mentioned transparency, and it would be ideal if the governor came out and addressed that point, whether he will or what will not. I won't hold my breath because, again, you know, there are all sorts of backroom deals cut late at night between political operatives that we never know about, or you hear whispers about, but you can never be sure. So that was my point, really, that it was just an observation. I don't know whether indeed it is fair for people to say that it's not Shaibu's turn. But certainly, if you look at the rotation around senatorial districts, that is an issue. We won't know for sure because it's unlikely that people will say their piece in public. It would be far better if they do. And then finally, for me on this point, something that Phoenix did say, that given the field of candidates that have thrown their hat into the ring, in all honesty, I'm not sure that you know, in a straight race, I'm not really sure that he measures up. But again, I make no direct you know, I have no dog in this fight. You know, I'm an interested observer, as are the both of you, and so they appear to have chosen a candidate who is pretty substantial. Whether this play has another act to run, as in, will Shaibu go back to court? You know, will he throw in the towel and just say, right, well, it's not happening, I've gone as far as I can go? Or will he say, well, I'm not done yet, and I'm going to take these guys on, and I'm going to go back to court? That will be interesting to watch.
Thank you, Dotun. My final question goes to Phoenix, and it's more of a translation issue. I think Dotun said something about to paraphrase. I think he said, "This na Nigeria, anything where we see, make we take them like that." For those of us who don't speak that genre of English, could you explain to us what Dotun was saying, Phoenix?
Sorry, what was the question?
I think Dotun said this Nigeria, anything where you see, make you take them like that. And I'm
Oh, that was from the eminent personality of Ambrosia Ijebu. You know, those on Nigeria Twitter sphere would recall the gentleman who would always regale us of tales of the inner workings of the Nigerian political class. And he always ended it, I think it was even on his bio, that this is Nigeria, anything you see, you take it like that. Just to explain Nigeria's anyhowness and the fact that, there's all, look at all the topics we've covered today, from Tinubu awarding a contract to his crony in broad daylight to EFCC going after somebody for spraying money when there are tons of videos of other people spraying money that they've not gone after. And now, Edo State, we're talking about, people making promises to each other, but deciding that things have changed, or the state assembly sitting to impeach with no clear impeachment offenses. It is Nigeria indeed. So, and it goes back to the point I was making about the Nigerian electorate and what kind of democracy they want. Maybe this it is this anyhow type of democracy that we truly want and deserve. So, gives us something to talk about week after week. People have been asking us, by the way, is this now a fortnightly podcast?
Well, as as you said, we'll tell them this is Nigeria. Anything they see, they have to
Exactly, they
take it
should
like
take
that.
it
So
like
that's why a weekly podcast can happen every 2 weeks. Yes, but anyway, apologies to our listeners because Phoenix is always traveling, so that's the problem. But
It's Phoenix now.
yes. But anyway, our time is up. So I must thank our guests. Thank you, Dotun, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here. Thank you, Phoenix, for co-hosting. And last but not the least, thank you to our listeners. Thank you for always badgering us for more episodes. And we pledge to do our best to make this weekly. I know we promised to make it weekly, and we will do our best to fulfill that promise. But until same time next week, I say have a fantastic 7 days to everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dalton, for joining us. Thanks, Michael, again. And thank you, listeners. Have a great week. Bye, everyone.